This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, brought to you in part by Flying Dog Media. For your next website design, visit flyingdogmedia.com. The Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression is the group behind the recent installation of the Community Chalkboard and Podium on the downtown mall. The chalkboard is the setting for a new lecture series this summer, and we bring you now the inaugural event with radio essayist Janice Jaquith.
Good evening. I'm Bob O'Neill, the director of the Thomas Jefferson Center. You've just seen Josh Wheeler, who is the associate director and the inspiration for our First Amendment monument slash chalkboard. This is a truly historic evening. Now, I suppose almost anything that happens in downtown Charlottesville is by definition historic, but this is an especially historic moment. Since the dedication of the chalkboard on April 20th of this year, we have been busily concentrating on ways in which to make it useful and to integrate it more fully with the community and especially with the east end of the downtown mall. We are this evening launching a series of evening programs, some of which will be conversations, some will be debates, some will be readings, and some we're not quite sure what they'll be, but they will take place here and they will be in the evening. We could hardly have chosen a better evening on which to launch this series. Nor could we have made a better choice of a person to be our first speaker, convener, and, as you will see momentarily, also an inspiration. Janice Jaquith has probably done more programs with and for the Thomas Jefferson Center than any other person. It includes at least two readings, a conversation with our trustee, Sissy Spacek, in the Paramount Theater about 15 months ago, which was an extraordinarily successful evening. And when asked whether she would be willing to inaugurate this series of evening conversations, once again, she readily agreed. It wouldn't be quite accurate to say that Janice Jaquith invented the radio essay. There are others, but she has been a pioneer. She has perfected the craft of using a radio segment, most particularly on public radio, to capsule a series of thoughts or experiences in a way that somehow just sticks with you far beyond the immediate moment. She is also, of course, a newspaper essayist, having published regularly in the Daily Progress and recently having moved over to The Hook, where you will now find her columns on a regular basis. The collection of her essays, to which I return periodically in search of wisdom or guidance, is entitled Birdseed Cookies. She is also now at work on a novel, which will give us insight into the tragic events of September 11th and the aftermath. But to say more would preempt her time, so let me simply welcome Janice Jaquith, thank her for being with us, and ask her to inaugurate our evening series. Janice?
Thank you very much for that introduction. Funny thing is about this chalkboard monument, I keep forgetting that the chalkboard is a monument to free speech, to the free expression that's guaranteed to all of us by the Constitution. I keep thinking of this thing as Charlottesville's free speech zone, as if this was the only place we have a right, you know, to say these things. And you know, don't you, why the term free speech zone is stuck in my head? It's because whenever President Bush makes an appearance, anyone who tries to get within sight or earshot of him in order to express disagreement with his policies, those dissidents are rounded up and put into a pen someplace, and they call that pen the free speech zone. So now I have this, you know, idea that I don't like at all, and I think that what we have is a new conceptual category in our heads of this limited way of thinking about speech and freedom, the free speech zone. So I think we need to reframe the free speech zone concept. We need to be reminded that the whole country is a free speech zone, from the mountains to the prairies to the proverbial oceans white with foam. And when I was a kid, our Sunday school teacher would say, "Where is God?" And I bet you remember the answer to this one. God is everywhere. So I had a great idea. I wrote a different last line that we can use when we're singing God Bless America. So the next time you are at a baseball game or watching it on TV and the seventh inning stretch comes and it's time to sing God Bless America, and I know you're singing along at home, doesn't everybody? Here's what I want us all to say at the very end. It's, God bless America, my free speech zone. That way, we will all remember that the right to free expression in the United States is everywhere. Wow, I just had my own soapbox moment at the, I think this is the only free speech monument, like anywhere, is that right?
Almost,
well. So it's very cool, my own soapbox moment. And my mother was here. How great is that? Well, speaking of free speech, I'm about to read to you an essay that I broadcast to a few million people on Marketplace, and I'm a little embarrassed now to think that I have done that, and yet not so embarrassed that I won't read it for you. It's called Confessions of a Video Trollop. That's a word I got from my mother, as in, don't be a trollop. I'm in a hotel room, doing what I do best in a hotel room, lying on the bed, propped up on pillows, squeezing the clicker again and again. I can do this for hours, until I drop off into a blissful sleep, exhausted, my fingers still clutching the remote control. You're probably wondering why I don't just stay home and enjoy these pleasures with my own television set. I'll tell you why. Because we are the last middle-class family in America that doesn't have cable TV. No cable TV, no microwave TV, no satellite TV. And as if that were not deprivation enough, we live in an area so rural that not only is there not a single Starbucks within 10 miles of us, but our rabbit-eared antenna can pull in just one channel. That's right, just one channel. This is the 21st century equivalent of having an outhouse. Do you know how sad it is to watch someone try to channel surf when there's only one channel? It's all my husband's fault. He says we'll never get cable for one reason, because you're never done paying for it. To sign up for cable TV would make Harry feel foolish, like some financial nitwit who isn't concerned about the final cost of anything, and whose only question to the salesman is, what are the monthly payments? And I know he's right. Think about it. Figure a monthly cable bill of at least $30. From the time you're out on your own until you retire is about 47 years. 47 years of cable bills at this rate adds up to nearly $17,000. Now, had you not been lining the pockets of the cable TV moguls for all those years, but had instead been stashing that $30 a month into a money market account or whatever, when retirement is upon you and you actually have some time to watch TV, your $17,000 would be worth a whole lot more. How much? I don't know. But you can bet it's a whole lot more than $17,000. Well, anyway, that's the gospel according to Harry. It feels like I'm married to a minister who doesn't just preach about moderation and abstinence, he lives it. Whenever I hear about some special show on one of the 9,000 channels I don't get, I feel so deprived, I find myself wondering if there are monasteries where the penitents wear hair shirts, flagellate themselves, and their TV has only one channel. I put up with this monastic life of mine as long as I can stand it, and then I'll contrive some kind of business trip that involves a night in a hotel, which is where I am now. So, if you'll excuse me, I will now lie back, sink into my pillows, and let the pleasure begin. Thought I'd pick on Harry for one more essay. This is another one that was on Marketplace. And the interesting thing was the editor I had there at the time, she said, you know, Janice, this has nothing whatever to do with Marketplace or economics or anything, but I just really like it. So they bought it. It's called Alone at Last. believe it or not, I was a little nervous. You know how you feel on a first date? Your stomach is kind of fluttery. Your heart is beating a little too fast for comfort. It was like that. I didn't know what I would say. I didn't know what he would say, but I was anticipating a sparkling conversation. I was in the passenger seat of our minivan as my husband and I cast a final look out the window and waved goodbye to all three of our children. For the first time ever, all of our kids were at summer camp. It cost a fortune, but that didn't bother me one bit. Why? Because for the first time in 12 years, Harry and I would have an uninterrupted conversation. For 2 weeks, we would be without children. Now I would have a good look at what life will be like when the kids are grown and gone, when we will go back to being our authentic adult selves, people who don't have to be stern, people whose heads do not reverberate with the unending high-pitched complaints of kids reporting who hit whom with what and where. But what will we talk about? Politics? Art? Existentialism? The words bounced around in my empty head. I used to know about stuff like that, I swear. But now, all that knowledge from books and lectures, entire semesters have been wiped out of my brain. Harry pressed his foot to the accelerator, and we barreled down the camp's winding gravel driveway, leaving a long cloud of dust in our wake. Before arriving at camp, the five of us had stopped at a country store for cold drinks. As we drove away from camp, Harry still held in his hand a bottle of root beer. He slowed down some as we approached the end of the driveway. One hand was on the steering wheel, one hand held the bottle aloft. And, like Hamlet, contemplating that skull in the graveyard scene, he gazed at the bottle. I could tell by the expression on his face that he was about to say something. He was gathering his thoughts, organizing them. I was relieved that he would speak first. What would we talk about? What kind of marriage-affirming conversation would we have now that we had left our distractions behind in the dust? And who had I been, anyway, before all this childbearing stuff had overtaken us? I was a graduate student of linguistics at an Ivy League school. So sophisticated. And Harry was a graduate student of theater and dramatic literature. Oh, what a reservoir of intellect between the two of us. We were at the end of the driveway. Before uttering a word, Harry took a swig of root beer and did his best to stifle a burp. He stopped before pulling out onto the road, turned to me and said, "Do you suppose you burp more when you drink soda out of a can or out of a bottle?" I don't know what happened to those sophisticated people we used to be. If we keep driving long enough, maybe we can track them down. And we're still married, even though that was broadcast all over the country. Mwah! And here's yet another marketplace piece. It's called Big Brother Discount. I'm standing at the customer service counter at the supermarket, and I am so nervous, you would think I was about to rob the place. In front of me is the form you fill out to get the store's discount card. You know, the grocery store card you use to get a good deal on diapers or whatever. A package of Pampers will be $10, but if you have a Big Brother card, it's like 85 cents. And you know, don't you, why those supermarkets are so desperate for you to use that card? To build a profile of you. If you buy, say, prunes and hair dye and Depends, you're in the old lady demographic. And if you're buying cigarettes and beer and Trojans, you're in another ballpark altogether. I despise these cards. Watching people hand them over at the supermarket, I've always wanted to yell, "Your every purchase is being monitored. Doesn't that bother you?" And what do they do with all that information about you? They swear the data is for their eyes only, to which I say, ha, there's nothing to stop them or a future owner of their assets from sharing this juicy information about your cigarette buying habits with, say, your health insurance company. Every time you use one of these cards, Kroger or Food Lion or whoever is compiling a dossier on you that would be the envy of J. Edgar Hoover or the NSA. But you probably know this already. I have been fuming for years every time I check out and the clerk asks if I have one of those creepy Big Brother discount cards. I usually explain why I don't have one. A few weeks ago, after perhaps my fourth time in the same clerk's checkout line, he leaned forward and said, "Look, don't use your real name. Most people don't. The woman behind me in line grinned and raised her eyebrows. I started asking around and discovered that everyone in America has been getting these cards with fake names. Who knew? Which is how I have wound up here, glancing at the clerk to see if she can tell that I'm about to make up a name. I consider Emily Dickinson. Will the clerk think that one's a howler, or has she even heard of Emily Dickinson? I glance up again. Hard to tell. Of course, hesitating over the name section of the form has to be a tip-off. My hand is shaken. I decide to use the name of a character in a story I'm writing. My name could be Franny Malatesta. I'm making up the address as I write it down. I hand over the form and look her right in the eye, which I suddenly realize is more suspicious looking than averting my eyes. She looks right back at me. I know what she's thinking. So, what'd you put down, honey? Mickey Mouse? Wile E. Coyote? Elvis? But she says nothing and hands me my discount card. I walk away, suddenly lighthearted. Big Brother may know my medical history and my driving record, but damn it, he doesn't get my grocery list. This is a column that appeared several years ago in the Daily Progress, but it's one that people mention, and I had forgotten I had written it. Typical that I would forget that I had written it. Maybe this will take your mind off the heat and you'll think about snow. Ah, winter, the season for roaring fires, hot chocolate, and parking out by the mailbox. If you're a city person, you probably don't know what I'm talking about. Parking the car out by the mailbox is what those of us who live out in the sticks and who don't have four-wheel drive vehicles do when a snowstorm is in the forecast. Our driveway is a fifth of a mile long and hilly. It doesn't take a whole lot of snow to leave our old Volvo stranded next to the house, where it's about as useful as a rowboat in the desert. Sure, we could hire someone to plow our ridiculously long driveway, but if we had that kind of money, there'd be an SUV in front of our house and we wouldn't need the plow. Our first winter out here, we were socked in good. I found myself trekking through knee-deep snow, trudging uphill to the car thinking, how long can this last? We're in the south. I figured the snow would be gone in 24 hours, 48 max. That was before I discovered our miniature ecosystem. The snow will have melted in every hollow and crevice in the county before my driveway becomes passable. This can translate into a week of schlepping people and groceries and two-ton book bags up and down those icy hillsides several times a day. The morning after the first storm, I mushed out to the car and tucked my daughter's flying saucer sled into the trunk before venturing out to the grocery store. When I got back to the mailbox, I lashed a knapsack full of groceries to the flying saucer, and as I gave it a push and let it rip down the hillside, I was thinking that I was such a genius for coming up with this delivery method. I was mentally composing my letter to Heloise, detailing this clever household hint, when the flying saucer skidded off the driveway and shot right into the pond. I'm from New England. This is not supposed to happen to me. I was born in Vermont and raised in Massachusetts. Snow would fall in December and would keep on coming until the end of March, when my mother and her friends would place bets on the final melting date of the biggest snow pile in the school parking lot. However, in New England, I never knew anyone whose driveway was longer than two car lengths, and we never, ever lost electricity due to a snow or ice storm. Never. Also, eastern Massachusetts, where I'm from, is remarkably flat. And so snow is not a big deal. Life goes on. When I moved to the south, I snickered at the locals' fear of a few measly inches of snow. A few inches? Oh, that's nothing. These people just don't know how to handle it. A few days after baptizing my groceries, my car was sliding sideways down a long, steep hill on Garth Road when it finally dawned on me that snow in the foothills of Virginia ain't nothing like snow in the flatlands of Massachusetts. My Virginia neighbors were amused and baffled to hear that we had bought a house so far off the road and didn't own a four-wheel drive. Come to think of it, if they're calling for snow and you see a car parked out by a mailbox, you can be pretty sure a Yankee lives there. I think this week in the progress, well, I've been following, Sunday in the progress, I know for sure, there's a, I think it's the beginning of a series about developments in Albemarle. So it's in that spirit that I'll read this, the column that appeared a few years ago in the Daily Progress. I should tell you first that Maupin's store is a little general store that's out in Free Union. It's a Friday afternoon at Maupin's store. I hold the door for a man shouldering a bag of poultry feed. He nods in my direction, and I go on in for my newspaper and half and half. After chatting a while with Mrs. Maupin, I fall into conversation with a carpenter who's paying for a six-pack. We talk about the huge houses going up around here. Turns out there are some truly monstrous houses in the works. One will be 17,000 square feet. As I head for the parking lot, all I can think is, 17,000 square feet for a house. I try to wrap my little mind around that. Back home in my not-quite-3,000-square-foot house, I dust off my calculator and discover that 17,000 square feet is somewhere between a third and half an acre. I'm still having a hard time visualizing this, so I call up a guy at Giant Food, and he tells me that your average giant grocery store is 55,000 square feet. So we're talking about roughly a third of a giant supermarket. That would be, I'm thinking, from produce all the way back to dairy and sweeping over to about the bread aisle. We're talking about a house here. I try to imagine vacuuming 17,000 square feet. Although, I suppose it would be a great place to bring up a bunch of kids. Wish I had that kind of space when my kids were growing up. Later, back at the store, I find out that the owners are a couple with no children. A couple? A couple of what? Elephants? How much space do these people need? I know, it's not about need. If it was about need, the couple could get by at a dorm room or a 7-Eleven. I'll try to put myself in their place. Here goes. Well, I've made it. Worked hard all my life, or for a year or two if I'm a CEO who cashed out 6 months after my IPO. And now I'm going to show the world just how successful I am. Going to build me a show place. Knock their socks off. All right. I admit I do understand the showplace concept, but for heaven's sake, show a little restraint. I'm very brave in these imaginary conversations with people I've never met. When you draw up those blueprints, pretend you come from old money. Ask yourself, what would old money do now? And know that if you follow through with that monstrous square footage, people will ride past your house and shake their heads in disgust, muttering about people with big money and little taste. And here's the kicker. From the time that house goes up, it's 5, maybe 7 years max before the moving trucks roll up and you shrug and yawn and say, ah, this place is too big. Well, duh, we could have told you that. Meanwhile, you'll take off for Florida or New York and we'll be left with this gaudy blot on the landscape. 17,000 square feet. Why? I once asked a neighbor of mine, who has since moved on to newer castles, why she had built such a huge house. Oh, she said, we entertain a lot. I wanted to say, look, honey, unless you're inviting the House of Representatives home for supper, what we have here is serious overkill. But I just smiled and tried to groan silently. I'm glad the carpenters have work, but lordy, 17,000 square feet? Continuing in the same vein, while I'm ranting, I keep ranting. This one's called A Revolting Development. And if you get that allusion to a 50s TV show, you're as old as I am. My doctor's appointment is in 4 minutes. I'm sitting in my car, my thumbs twitching against the steering wheel, wondering when traffic will start moving again. Great, now we're rolling. But why so slow? I'm not on a highway. I'm not in a city. I'm not even in the suburbs. I'm on a road in the country. Where did all these cars come from? Where did all these people come from? And it gets worse every day. When I moved here 6 years ago, I could stop my car in the middle of this road and look at the mountains for a minute or two, and no one would come up behind me. That's 6 years ago, not 60. Now, I like to think of myself as a kind, reasonable person, but this self-image has been put to the test lately by a villain. That villain is the developer. Like Jerry Seinfeld saying, Newman, that word is uttered with disdain around my house. Developer. I have no problem with builders who put up a house here or a house there, especially when the impact on the surrounding land is minimal. The real villain, the snidely whiplash of rural America, is the developer who comes in with bulldozers and destroys a tract of graceful, picturesque landscape, replacing our beautiful countryside with dozens, sometimes hundreds of houses. This morning, I'm rolling along at 5 miles an hour past a bright green field with cows the color of heavy cream. Butterflies dance around blue cornflowers at the edge of the road, and I wonder, how soon will it be before these cows are evicted, the rolling field flattened, all of this replaced by acres of aluminum and vinyl boxes, a checkerboard of little yards saturated with herbicides and insecticides where no butterfly will survive. And every house has at least two cars. Sitting in traffic and thinking about developers is an unhealthy combination. My blood pressure must be through the roof. I tell myself, breathe deeply, relax those shoulders, think of this as a lazy tour of the countryside, and think of the developer. He has a family to feed, maybe kids in college, and this is how he makes his living. Who are you to tell this guy he can't feed his family? He means no harm. This is where my internal dialogue heats up. Okay, I understand he means no harm. Just like the termites that are destroying the floor under your feet, they mean no harm. It's not personal. They're just very good at what they do. We're moving faster now, 27 miles an hour. The woman behind me in the black Suburban is tailgating so close she's practically in my back seat. If I wanted to be this close to strangers, I would have moved to New York. My question for the developer is this: how will you know when you're done? Will it be when every farm and forest and meadow is covered with houses and stores and asphalt? And what will you do then? What will you do once you've ruined everything? If the answer is go someplace else, why don't you go there now? Right now. Just don't go by car because you'd never get out of here. Take a plane. Take a helicopter. Take a hike. Let's see. I have three more of these. This one was for WVTF, and it is about becoming obsolete. Hot sun and cool shade. A perfect day for an outdoor graduation. It was spring, 2001, and our daughter, Jill, our youngest, was about to walk down that grassy aisle and out of our lives. Rows of folding chairs were arranged on the lawn of Tandem Friends School under a canopy of shifting leaves. The graduates, all 31 of them, had made their entrance and now sat on a stage in front of us. For once, I could stare at my daughter uninterrupted. I wanted to memorize her, the way she sat up so straight, hair swirling in the breeze. My thoughts wander back over the past 21 years that I've been a stay-at-home mother, teaching all three of them to read when they were toddlers, and once they were in school, coaxing and bribing and cheering them through homework and those science projects involving styrofoam balls and toothpicks. There were frantic trips to Kmart to ferret out that day's holy grail, orange poster board, a marble cover notebook, items they invariably waited until the night before to tell me about. And now the speechifying is done. The diplomas have been handed out. I don't want to leave. I love this place. The field trips, volunteering on soup day, bringing corn and cheddar chowder in that swell insulated carrying case. When will I ever use that again? I like sitting out here on the lawn under the outstretched arms of ginkgo trees. I look around at the families I've come to know over the years. The girls my daughter went snowboarding with at Wintergreen. The kids who sang and played in the rock bands at Tandem's Mother's Day Festival. And a few kids who were in and out of trouble and came close to missing out on graduation altogether. Adolescence is such a minefield for all of us. But here they are. They made it. And they made it together, helping each other out in ways they'll likely never tell us about. When will I see these people again? Chat with these mothers. Find out what's going on with their kids. This place where I chaperoned, set up the silent auctions, and dropped off and picked up at the front door every day, in a few minutes, I won't belong here anymore. Jill will start a new life at college, but I don't think Virginia Tech is looking for room mothers or parent volunteers in the classroom. I doubt that I'll be getting a call from a professor some evening asking me to send 2 dozen cupcakes to class the next day for the Halloween party or whatever. Suddenly I feel very old. Everyone standing up and applauding as the fresh high school graduates stride down the aisle. Except I'm not applauding. I'm rooting around in my pocketbook for Kleenex. The tears slide down my cheeks like this was a funeral instead of a commencement. I gotta pull myself together. A friend steps over and takes me in her arms, and I sob like part of me has died. I think I'm molting like a lobster or a snake, shedding my motherhood shell, this husk of myself that I leave behind on the lawn and watch as it blows away. As it turns out, I belong at Tandem again because they asked me to be on the board, so now I get to hang out there. I have two more here. This one was an essay I did broadcast on WVTF, and it's called Inside Over Here. That's what I call it. No one ever hears a title on the radio. It's from a play on words from a Maurice Sendak children's book called Outside Over There. Finding out the sex of your baby before birth, doesn't that spoil the surprise? A quarter century ago, when the depths of my swollen belly were plumbed with sonar, my twin sons looked like a pair of high-pressure areas on a weather map. We had to assume that what we were seeing was human. Discerning whether they were boys or girls wasn't part of the picture. And anyway, I always figured that gathering detailed information about what was inside there would be like peeking inside a wrapped-up present before Christmas. You could do it, but why would you? And then, my son sent me an ultrasound image of my first grandchild. I knew that Tricia, his wife, was scheduled for an ultrasound that morning. She was 4 months pregnant. Jackson called me and announced that he just had a first look at his daughter. A daughter! I congratulated him, promised to check my email for the ultrasound photo he had just scanned for me, and oh, by the way, he says they will name her Ida, after the heroine of Maurice Sendak's story, Outside Over There. Ida. Before I could even take my hand off the receiver, fragments from Jackson's childhood shot through my mind like splinters of lightning. Worrying about him and his twin before they were born. Worrying about him when he lost a kidney to a tumor. Worrying that he'd end up being a father before he was old enough to be a husband. But here he is, 25 years old, married, and... My eyes stung, my knees buckled, and I sank to the kitchen floor, allowing the sobs to pulse through me. And he and his wife are bringing into the world their first child, a daughter, Ida. I'd had no idea that this mid-pregnancy revelation is now one of life's big moments, right up there with, will you marry me, and the tumor was benign. I sat down at my computer and clicked on Jackson's message. Up popped a crisp image, a profile as clear as if it had been conjured by a psychic in her crystal ball. Revealing that my granddaughter will have her father's forehead, her aunt's nose, and her mother's chin. With a few elegant lines, the ultrasound made palpable this child who is still blossoming inside her mother. A child who won't find out what we look like until Christmas Eve, Trish's due date. I sat there for a long time, entranced by this surreal image. A distilled, exquisite profile of a tiny head, the familiar tilt of the high, brief nose, the long upper lip, the curve of the back of the head, a head that I will soon cradle in my palm, savoring the warmth and weight of it, a contour that whispered, little girl, Ida, you are one of us. And Ida has a little brother or sister that will be due in February, so we have another grandchild. And here's my last essay. It's called A Virtual Undertaking. And explains why I don't write as much as I should, because I have an addiction. anyway, it's called A Virtual Undertaking. This is a huge undertaking, and I am obsessed with it. I've gathered a few hundred photos, and I'm putting them all on a DVD, creating a display for my family, a reason to gather, tell stories, and remember. I'm scanning these family photographs, feeding them into my computer, and one by one they appear like magic on my screen, after images of youth and life. Hunched over my iMac for hours, I forget to sleep, I forget to eat. The room around me fades away, and I am drawn into the luminous image on my screen. I don't want to stop. I tell myself, just one more picture. And then, with the click of a mouse, I conjure the dead. These pictures are familiar. I've seen them in albums and shoeboxes over the years. But the paper photos are different. They are small, the people dwarfed by sky and trees and sand, by furniture and wallpaper. Those brownie cameras and Instamatics were not close-up friendly. Look at this paper snapshot of my parents as newlyweds. It's faded and yellowed. There are tiny white spots all over it. It's mostly houses, beach, and strangers on blankets. My parents are the ones looking at the camera. But now I'll scan it, feed it into my computer, and watch what happens. One click and the extraneous background and the strangers fall away, and we're left with the entwined young couple who now fill the screen. Using every software tool I can think of, I enhance this photograph. What time has faded and yellowed, I resurrect with color correction and sharpened contrast. I erase the spots on their skin, in their hair, and fill in scratches and creases. And then the magic happens. I sit back and marvel at the restoration of my father, a young man brought back to life, and of my mother's astonishing, improbable youth. Scenes from the past so real, I inhabit them. Now I see the expressions on their faces. My mother encircles Dad's neck and shoulder with her arms. Her head rests against his. She smiles hugely at the camera. Everything about her says, "This guy is mine." Dad tilts his face toward Mom's, but his eyes are on the camera, and there's a wicked twinkle in them. Before, I knew from the writing on the back that this was the picture taken in 1941 in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Now, I know that this is a picture of what being in love looks like. Fussing with these images feels like a kind of grooming, the way I once looked after my dolls, brushing their hair, then later with my kids, using Kleenex and spit to forefinger a smudge from a cheek. Now I'm grooming, nitpicking, fussing with images, preserving the past the way a mortician cares for the dead, displaying for family what has been lost, and providing a reason to gather, tell stories, and remember. Thank you. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Janice Jaquith at the Community Chalkboard and Podium, a program of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. For more on the series, visit the center's website at tjcenter.org. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com, supported in part by Flying Dog Media. For your next website design, visit flyingdogmedia.com. Thanks for listening.